Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and this is the audio cast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include transhumanism, bioethics, radical life extension, cosmology and metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, podcasting to you today on Sunday, January the 14th. Today I'm joined by a very special guest from San Francisco. It's Michael Anisimov. Many of you who listen to my podcast may be familiar with Michael and his writing and his work. He is the fundraising director in North America for the Lifeboat Foundation. He is also a founding director of the Immortality Institute. He's a prolific blogger at Accelerating Future, where he focuses on such topics as existential risks, the promise and peril of advanced artificial intelligence, biotechnology, transhumanism, nanotechnology, and much, much more. Michael, welcome to Sentient Developments Radio.
Hey, George.
And how are you on this fine Sunday?
Good, good. It's cold over here by my standards.
Well, today was the same here today, based on the standards we've had so far this winter. It's the first snowfall that we've had thus far, and as you might have picked up from my blog post from earlier today, I was quite relieved to see that. Well, for those who may not be familiar with the Lifeboat Foundation, Michael, could you just very briefly describe what it's all about, what its initiatives are, and what its general agenda is?
Well, the Lifeboat Foundation is a gathering of scientists and intellectuals and anyone who is interested in getting involved, and the goal is to analyze the possible existential risks that will be threatening humanity over the next few decades and beyond, and to come up with a comprehensive set of solutions to mitigate those risks. So it's a very multi-pronged project. One of the unifying themes is that if we had a autonomous space habitats off-planet, then it would be putting our eggs in more than one basket, and we would have we've spread ourselves to the point where we'd be able to avoid lots of the big hits, even though there would still be threats that might be able to hit people even if they're in a space colony, but it just eliminates a large class of threats. So that's one of our goals.
So do you don't discriminate between, let's say, man-made type disasters and those that might be caused through, I guess, natural disasters?
No, existential risk encompasses things that are both natural or artificial, but I personally believe, and many others do as well, that the natural risks are much greater in magnitude.
Really, that's almost hard to believe, given not just my own, I guess, observations, but even reading your own accounts. Wouldn't you say that things like nano and AI pose a much more tangible risk than, let's say, a meteorite strike?
Yeah, no, that's what I meant. That's what I meant.
Oh, I'm
artificial.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. And speaking of those things, then how do you, I guess, assess the various risks facing us right now? I know it's a very broad question, but I'm just kind of interested to know some of the conversations that you're having and some of the items that are initially on your watch list.
Well, the thing is, not anyone, no one person can be an expert in everything. So no matter how widely read a single individual is, they have a lot to learn from people who are experts in their respective fields. So a lot of the object at Lifeboat Foundation is bringing together people from various disciplines and creating an interdisciplinary dialogue about it. And sometimes, you know, a nanotech expert being exposed to the issues surrounding artificial intelligence or biotechnology might be confronting these issues for the first time, but considering that lots of these experts are people who are just brilliant in general, not just in their specific field, they can, when they wrap their heads around this new problem, they can contribute a lot. So there's lots of cross-pollination going on there. And we pick and choose scientists that they come to our attention and invite them to get involved, invite them to join discussions, invite them to collaborate on reports and the like.
Now, aside from discussions and getting the ideas out there on the table, what kind of an impact could you ever hope to achieve with the Lifeboat Foundation?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, it seems like there is a need for it because there is no other organization that exists to address all existential risks and develop countermeasures to the whole range of them. So even if we just sit around and publish papers, I think it's better than not having Lifeboat Foundation at all. But it just so it so happens that our ambitions do extend beyond that. We are raising money for projects like an electromagnetic launching initiative, where it's a group of students and a professor who the goal is to create a launcher that it's just a small scale launcher that's a test of a larger principles of regarding like electromagnetic mass drives and that whole thing, which is an area of space launch that hasn't been thoroughly explored. And we also have a set of a prize called the A Prize for involving, we would give away a prize to the first group that creates synthetic life. So those would be two examples of concrete initiatives that aren't just publishing papers.
Now, you are the fundraising director in North America for the Lifeboat Foundation. Could you describe how you go about this and, again, some of the goals that you've established for yourself?
Well, let's see. Right now, last week I wrote a rough draft of a Lifeboat Foundation brochure, which is the type of thing that we be able to distribute at conferences. I think that content is king, no matter whether it's a blog or a website or anything. So one of my main goals is to build up content for the Lifeboat website. I recently started writing a blog for Lifeboat, which you can find at lifeboat.com/blog, and hope to make entries in there, if not every day, then every other day. I did an interview with Alan Goldstein last week. We invite scientists on our scientific advisory board, but I'm also encouraging them to actually become supporting members of the organization, and which, since our organization, the lowest level starts off at merely $10 per month, I'm trying to encourage people to sign up for that. And I've had some success over the last few weeks and months.
I've recently subscribed to your Lifeboat blog. It's quite good, and I'm looking forward to some of the future posts. I think it's a great idea to have a blog, I guess, dedicated to these particular issues. Now, I also know that Eric Klein is involved, am I correct, with the Lifeboat Foundation. Is that right?
Yeah, he's the founder.
He is the founder, Eric Klein. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that. Oh, excellent.
Yeah,
okay.
He likes to kind of put himself in the background sometimes.
Now, I guess I kind of I still want to stay on Lifeboat. You've described, I guess, your outlook as being, in perhaps speaking on behalf of the Lifeboat Foundation, as being cautiously pessimistic. Can you just elaborate on what you meant by that?
Well, when you read like literature in the area of heuristics and biases and cognitive psychology and human biases, which I know you've blogged about, and many people have started to get more familiar with, you see that humans have a tendency to be excessively optimistic on a wide range of things. Like, anytime we set out a project, studies show that we always underestimate the amount of time it takes, we always underestimate the costs, and we just seem to have tendencies to be, we have measurable tendencies to be excessively optimistic. I think that, it's in futurism specifically, and in transhumanism, our minds get opened up to all these great opportunities like abundance and extremely extended lifespans and cognitive upgrades and all that great stuff. And it's so exciting that sometimes it takes a year or two or maybe a few years for people to kind of get used to those opportunities and start to think about the more serious and somber side of things, and which is the point that I've come around to.
I recall Sir Martin Rees, who in his book Our Final Hour gave humanity's odds of surviving the 21st century at 50-50. Would you be willing to give your own assessment and put the odds down of what you think our odds are of surviving? Is that even a fair question? Is that, again, perhaps a poor way of phrasing the issue?
Well, it's not, because a guess is just a guess, and it's not necessarily, even though I do pay a lot of attention to these things, there's no special reason why my guess is any better than anyone else's. I'm actually less optimistic than 50-50. Maybe I'd say more like 2-1. I think it's more likely
right.
that we'll mess up. but I'm not so pessimistic that I'm defeatist about it.
I share your pessimism, and there are times when I'm in absolute denial about our chances, and I try to avoid these discussions altogether, and I'll go through a phase where maybe for a couple of weeks my blog posts completely avoid any of these kind of darker themes. Michael, how do you your work is obviously very you're very close to the Lifeboat Foundation, and the topic of existential risks obviously is something that interests you greatly. How do you get up every day and continue to kind of hammer away at these topics without letting it get you down?
I'm fortunate that I was exposed to them what I consider to be a long time ago, about 5 years ago at least. I was exposed to Grey Goo maybe like 10 years ago. But I've been exposed to the issues for long enough that they've synced with my mind. And if we are successful in navigating past these risks, the reward that is at the end of the road, there's no end to the road, of course, it's an ongoing journey, but the rewards of a world where the probability of risk has been pushed down to basically zero, the benefits are so great that that negates any of the pessimism or depression that could come about from considering existential risks all day.
Now, I recall it was several months ago you had a blog post that that received a wide amount of attention, and it was in regards to, I believe it had to do with, I guess you presented several hypothesized scenarios for the detonation of a nuclear explosion. And if I recall correctly, you received a lot of criticism about it, and I wouldn't mind hearing you, in your own words, defend these types of posts where you very explicitly, in a way, describe the kinds of catastrophes that could be put together.
Well, I think that in order to get any point across, in order to convey any concept, there needs to be a lot or as much detail as possible. So I think that there's a tendency, because of the negativeness of thinking about existential risk, and I mean, people don't like to talk about how I might die. You know, if they do, they tend to talk about it in like in a joking way, practically. If they're our ages, you know, if they are not really about to die, then they'll talk about it in a joking way. Anything to get away that depression that can come with thinking about these really serious issues. But I think that when someone is willing to confront the issues head on, look at them in detail, and build up scenarios for the ways things that could go wrong, people think about it in a much more detailed way, and it strikes home with them. So they might not dismiss it as they would have otherwise if they had only seen it being referred to in passing, which is what is how you frequently see discussions of existential risk.
Now, one might play devil's advocate for just a moment. Are you perhaps being somewhat of a menace by putting out, let's say, some of the details down as to how some of these catastrophes could actually be engineered? In what way do you see this as being somewhat proactive and even beneficial?
I hold back a lot of details that come to mind, so I'm not putting out. I'm putting out less than half the details that I have thought through. The idea is, if I say, okay, maybe if someone were to drop a nuke at Cumbre Vieja in La Palma, where there is a 5-square-mile rock waiting there, ready to crash into the ocean if it's triggered in the wrong way. Well, I think that it could actually encourage people to take action about it. Like, if the government were to just deploy maybe a couple of soldiers full-time to scan that island and for unusual activity, I think it would be of great benefit. That's just one example. And whenever people's attention is turned towards risks, they are motivated to do something about them. And it's kind of, it makes me feel kind of, I don't know, it makes me feel bad to think about it, but I feel that if a nuclear device were detonated in a city and hundreds of thousands of people did die, it could actually, the counter measures that people would take afterwards would reduce the risk so greatly that it might save more lives in terms, like, if you want to think about it in terms of utility, it might save a million people or 5 million people or 10 million people if something bad happens such that people's attention is turned towards it. So I'm not proposing that someone nuke a city, but I think that putting out a straightforward and well-detailed scenario like that makes it clear in someone's mind, almost as if it had happened, but it didn't happen. So it's a good thing, and they're thankful for it, and they might consider countermeasures they wouldn't have otherwise, spend time on that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Now, you've also been fairly outspoken in what's going on right now in terms of the potential proliferation of nuclear weapons, both in Iran and, of course, most recently in North Korea. Did you want to just quickly talk about those situations and even some of your own prescriptions for these issues?
Well, it's a very difficult and politicized issue, the what to do about these things. I grew up in San Francisco, and I have a lot of social liberal views, but I am partially persuaded by the arguments that I see George Bush putting forth, even though I realize, with respect to Iraq specifically, because this is a testing ground. It's a testing ground of what the United States is willing, how much we're willing to play world police. And I wish that if there weren't a need for a world police, I wish that there were a strong international community that could actually pressure people. It's a rogue state. First of all, I want to make clear that I think that Iran and North Korea are rogue states that are threatening to the international community and themselves. Now, whether or not that means that they should be attacked, of course it doesn't. It would be best if anything, if all these issues could be solved diplomatically, but I worry that some issues cannot be solved diplomatically, and there might be a large armed confrontation in the next 10 to 20 years, if not next 5 years, over either North Korea or Iran. And also, there are numerous states in the Middle East, including Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, that have announced that they are going to pour more energy into nuclear technology. So what I see is like a huge potential proliferation disaster. And I'm fortunate that I don't need to focus on nuclear issues as much because there are already people focusing on it. I think that I'd like to spend some of my attention on the more neglected risks, like the risk from nanotech and AI, but I'd like to point to these nuclear confrontations as solid evidence that, yes, nations do get in scuffs with each other. Yes, they do disregard the international community. Yes, they are threats to people around them, and if they're doing this with nuclear weapons, then imagine what will happen when we see post-nuclear next-generation warfare.
Well, let's talk about that for just a moment, and I think that the analogies to nuclear proliferation and nanoproliferation are fair analogies. Beyond, let's say, having the United States have to police the globe, how could nano in particular ever be contained? And what kind of, let's say, political organization or even some kind of institutional setup could be established such that these sorts of threats could, in fact, be contained?
Well, like James Hughes, I'm a world federalist, and I think that if there were a unified world government, then it would be able to do a great amount of good. And I think that it's more likely it would do good than bad, even though I can't see into the future no more than anyone else. But it's infeasible at this time. The world is not going to unify. But I think that international threats will require international regulatory agencies. They will require international enforcement policies. And the more international you get, the more force needs to be projected on an international plane to guard the freedoms that we tend to enjoy today. Today we're safe because distance protects us and a lack of self-replicating technology protects us. To make a nuke, it requires a massive infrastructure. Even to make a car requires a massive infrastructure. We're going to be transitioning to a new mode where this scale of infrastructure to create dangerous objects, dangerous products, is not required, where it can be a personal one person can cause huge problems.
And that's actually a very frightening prospect, because when we're talking about, let's say, nuclear weapons, we're actually talking about 1940s era technology. And Here we are in the early 21st century watching the rest of the world, I guess, play catch up and modernize. And it really should come as no surprise that, of course, they would come into the possession of technology that's now 60 plus years old.
Yeah.
Now, in regards, let's move to kind of to issues of AI, because I know that's another topic that you're very familiar with. Is again, perhaps speaking a bit more philosophically now, is, and again, I'm sure most of the listeners know what I mean when I talk about friendly AI. Friendly AI, of course, being an advanced artificial intelligence that, at least in theory, wouldn't be either poorly programmed or malevolent or misguided. Michael, in your own opinion, is even this possible? Because there have been so many discussions that I've been reading now where I'm somewhat swayed on the side of the discussion that says that friendly AI is somewhat of a pipe dream.
Eliezer Yudkowsky has a nice page about this that's linked from the Singularity Institute publications page, where he not argues for any specific plan, but he argues for the feasibility of friendly AI in general. I do think that friendly AI is feasible for many reasons, but it would be complicated to go into it. If there are nice human beings, and that right there is existence proof that a nice agent can exist. Now, whether or not there can be nice agent that has access to its own source code and continues to be nice to human beings, even if it can yank out that programming at will, it's a complicated set of philosophical and technical issues. I believe strongly that friendly AI is possible, but whether or not we'll be able to come up with a specific plan in time, I'm not sure.
Reading on your website, obviously you're a transhumanist, being a life extensionist and a member of the WTA. You had an excellent post recently on cybernetic upgrades. Just want to know what kind of response did you get, and did you want to just very briefly maybe talk about some of the highlights of that article?
I got a good response. I just did it as a fun thing and kind of like a way of showing to people that maybe weren't so well exposed to transhumanism what it's all about. You've been hit with kind of a media flurry over the past few days, and I noticed that you're starting to put little dig buttons on the bottom of your posts.
Yes.
On your blog. Yeah. I think that transhumanists, I've spent a lot of time on transhumanist mailing lists over the last few years speaking with other transhumanists, and I'm kind of tired of doing that. I think it's really important to preach outside of the choir. So,
yes.
Yeah. So I just want to do something that's simple, easy, fun. So yeah, I just thought up 10 upgrades. There are many, many more than 10 upgrades, of course, that anyone could brainstorm. But I just thought up 10 that I thought would be fun, accessible, interesting, not what people would automatically think. I picked out some images that I thought would be fun to go along with it, and I got a good response. It didn't catch fire over the internet, didn't reach the front page of Dig, but I get a decent amount of traffic, and I get a decent amount of feedback, both via the comments and email, and anytime I introduce a new concept to someone or get someone more excited about transhumanism, it makes me feel really happy.
Now, are you still able to devote any time and resources to the Immortality Institute?
I participate on the message boards, but in terms of formal participation, not really. I'm a member of the community. That's about it.
Now, I wouldn't mind asking you some, I guess, more personal level questions. Wondering, as a life extensionist, do you practice any life extension practices?
Do I practice any life extension practices? Well, I'm a vegetarian right now, and I get a decent amount of exercise, but as far as, like, I don't take supplements, I don't jog regularly. I walk a lot of places because I live in the city and I don't have a car. But I did an interview with Psychology Today, the magazine, about 2 months ago, and I believe in the March issue, they're coming out with an article that has me in it, where I talk about how it's an article that goes into people with non-orthodox views, and this gal picked me up, or saw me via Immortality Institute, saw my posting on the Immortality Institute, so we got in contact via that, and I did an interview about being a immortalist in a world of people that are very skeptical of the idea. So I contribute, that's how I contribute to the immortalist movement today.
You're a Bayesian, right?
I want to be Bayesian, yeah.
I guess we all strive, to kind of have that particular outlook. Can I ask you, are there any examples of how you could apply, let's say, Bayesian rationality to your day-to-day life, or is that too strange a question?
I'd need to, or this is like an ongoing thing that everyone should consider. The first most obvious is to try to eliminate the salient, or to be familiar with the biases that have been studied out there in the literature, and be familiar with some of the shocking results of these experiments. Like, these cognitive psychologists set people up, like the Wasson selection task is a famous one, where not only do people get the wrong answer in this task, they have a tendency to defend their wrong answer even after they've been shown that it's wrong.
Wow.
And they, these cognitive psychologists are geniuses. They, in order to really like bring out the bias, they keep shoving their experimental subjects into they allow the subjects to shove themselves into a corner more and more, to the point, and even these are like students at Yale, students at Harvard, students at Stanford. It doesn't really matter where they're from. It shows that like even so-called smart people can be made to look like doofuses when you're exploiting a bias that's pan-human and universal and built into our species. So the one of the first steps of becoming a Bayesian rationalist is to, like a sculptor, shave off the most obvious biases, and then further steps can come after that.
Now, you and I share similar taste in music. What are you listening to these days?
I'm listening to a mix of metal and experimental, and let's see, I'll open up my Winamp real quick. Or I'm listening to Dr. Octagon right now.
Okay.
It's Dan Automator, who's part of Gorillaz, is one of the dudes in that, and then Cool Keith is the other guy. He raps about like microscopes and like space travel and nerdy stuff like that. So,
are you able to see any live shows in San Francisco?
I usually don't hit up shows. Like, I might go to a club once every couple months or something, but I'm not huge on shows now.
One last question for you, and because we are nearing the 30-minute mark, wondering what are some of your future goals, both with the Lifeboat Foundation and even with your own goals at a personal level, and it can be, I guess, short to medium term.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the Lifeboat Foundation, I've been really pleased at the growth that it's shown only in the past 6 months. I've been really excited about it. There was an article by David Brin that got to the front page of Dig, and we've been getting a lot of traffic through Dig, through Reddit, through StumbleUpon.
Oh, excellent.
It's my goal to transform that traffic, just plain eyeballs, into people who are actually interested in participating on a closer level and following this stuff for the longer term, and also feeling like a personal stake in it, instead of just like, hey, these guys are doing X, more like, maybe I should be doing X. So that, for the Lifeboat, that's what I want to do. And as I said, content. I think content is king, so I want to produce a lot of content for Lifeboat in this upcoming year. And on the personal side, I'm putting together an outline for a book, and I want to write a book this year, and I don't care whether or not it's published by a prominent publisher or whether I get a book deal or whatever. I just want to write, say, like 300 pages on issues that I think are important, and publish it maybe via lulu.com, you know?
Right. Well, excellent. Best of luck with that. I'm certainly I've been procrastinating on my own book for the longest time now, but we'll see what 2007 will bring for me in that regard. Michael, thank you so much for joining me today on my Sentient Developments podcast. All the best of luck to you in your future and in all your goals. Once again, we were joined today by Michael Anisimov, who's the fundraising director for the Lifeboat Foundation and a co-founder of the Immortality Institute. Michael, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, George.
Cheers.
Oh,